This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and we have a great show for you today. At the top of the show, we're joined by Pablo Morales, filmmaker behind Gringos at the Gate. And Pablo's going to break down today's action, look at tomorrow's action, and give us the lowdown on where he feels the Mexican national team stands following their exit from the 2010 World Cup tournament. Then we're joined by a local Los Angeles partisan of the Portuguese national team, Fátima Márquez. She'll tell us about the excitement that the Southern California Portuguese community feels on the eve of their showdown with Spain. Likewise, in this great metropolitan area, there's a small group of Paraguayans, and they'll be pulling for their national side against Japan in tomorrow's other match. And we'll be joined by Jose Perez to relay the enthusiasm of Paraguay for their national side in 2010. And lastly, we're honored to be joined by David Winner. He is the author of my now all-time favorite book about soccer called Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. Now, I'm not particularly a partisan of the Dutch side. I'm highly appreciative of total football and the great players that have come out of Holland in recent decades. But simply put, this is a brilliant work of soccer sociology, and I recommend it to all of you out there. And we are thrilled to have David Winner on the show today. You will hear the first third of our extended interview that we did with David Winner at the tail end of today's show. So stay tuned. There's all that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by a co-host on the show, Pablo Morales, who is the genius behind the film Gringos at the Gate. Welcome, Pablo.
Wow, first time I've ever been called a genius in a public setting. Thank you, Alan.
Well, we're talking about, you know, Brilliant Orange on the show today, the neurotic genius of Dutch football.
Well, my mother's Dutch, so maybe that's where it comes from.
Anyway, so today's matches, what did you make of them? Two of the tournament's big teams, Holland and Brazil, passed through the second round. Now they're going to be facing each other in the quarters. What did you make of it?
Well, in the Dutch game this morning, I felt the Dutch were doing exactly what they were doing in the first round, just playing well enough to win. They had their foot off the accelerator most of the time. They were daring Slovakia to attack them, and for the most part, they weren't. Slovakia weren't really up to the task. I really not that much to say about it, except it was enjoyable to watch on the level of, you know, what's Holland going to do on the counterattack, but not exactly riveting football. In terms of the second game with Brazil, I felt so bad for Chile because, you know, if there's one team in South America that just can never beat Brazil, it's Chile. You know, no matter how good their teams are, Brazil has their number. And I think this Chile side was one of their best, one of the most balanced for sure. And they just came across a Brazil side that they were firing on all cylinders, actually. There were some players out there that, like Robinho, who, you know, had turned it on at the right times and scored a beautiful goal. My God. And so the result was not unexpected, I guess. It was a shame that we didn't get any historical result out of it, or at least a closer game.
Well, the question is have the Dutch really been not putting their foot down on the accelerator? And if they haven't, do they have enough to challenge Brazil? And I would certainly concur that Ian Robin was not going all out today, especially after the first goal. And there's more that he can bring into the game, and we'll see that, of course, against Brazil. But is there enough there with this Dutch team to challenge the Brazilians?
Well, obviously, I mean, they have one of the best midfielders in Schneider in the world, who's quick and has an amazing shot, scored a very nice goal, and Coit, who is one of the best hustlers. My feeling is that you've seen this Dutch team play when they wanted to play, and they were effective and fun and still capable of the total football of overlapping fullbacks and just switching play on a dime. Yeah, it, you know, here's the thing. They haven't had to play at 100% yet. They will have to play at 100% against Brazil. So will they do it? That's the question. You know, and if they do, it will be a game, you know, to rival the game Germany against Argentina, the other quarterfinal where, you know, has an amazing, generally a semifinal feel to it.
Well, looking at tomorrow, of course, we have Japan and Paraguay, and they'll play the winner of Spain and Portugal, which means that there'll really be sort of three underdogs in the quarterfinals and five teams that came into the tournament hoping to or expecting to challenge for the title. So Spain and Portugal also has the feel of a potential classic, the Iberian Showdown. So first of all, what do you make of Paraguay and Japan, and then, of course, Spain and Portugal tomorrow?
Well, if Japan plays like they played their final two games in the first round, it's going to be wide open and fun to watch. Paraguay, you know, Paraguay to me is a bit of an enigma. They did so well in South American qualifying. They've got always world-class strikers. And I'm actually looking forward to that game a lot. I was impressed with the Blue Samurai, whose games leading up to the World Cup were poor, as is a nice way of saying it. They looked like they were going to be gone in the opening round of the way they had played, but they did very well. And their free kicks were so amazing. I know that that'll be an entertaining game, and it's great that I would actually like Japan to go through, because I'd love to see an Asian team in the final eight.
Spain-Portugal.
Spain-Portugal, the Iberian classic. No, they're not a classic. Why aren't they a classic? Because both teams tend to underperform. On the field, quite a list of world-class players on both sides. So you've got Portugal, who had their one big blowout of goals against North Korea, who were by far the doormat of the opening round. But beyond that, they didn't look tremendously powerful. Outside of that game, you know, Ronaldo hasn't scored, hasn't proven himself the amazing free kick taker that everyone looks for in terms of his play for originally Manchester United and now at Real Madrid. Spain, champions of Europe, beautiful team to watch, but has a tendency to fold in the big tournament, the World Cup. Now that they've won a European championship again after 44 years, you can't say that they don't win championships, but the World Cup is its own special place. I looked for Spain to win this game. They're so much more deep than Portugal, and I really feel like they still are a class side. And then whoever wins Japan-Paraguay, I just don't see either of those teams really beating Spain if they're on form. And so Spain is a pretty good, I think, once they get past Portugal, good clear shot to the semis.
Pablo, your film is Gringos at the Gate, and it documents the USA versus Mexico soccer rivalry, in particular these past couple of decades. Mexico has been sort of an established side in the world that fits in between, basically, you know, first round, they'll get through, second round, and they're out. So they rank in the world always, it seems, between 9 and 16. Mm-hmm. And while the team had promise, it seems that they're still stuck on that plateau. I know that a lot of people in Southern California were believing more than that from this team. And, of course, if they had proceeded and passed through their group and been in the place where Uruguay now is in the draw, they would have had a nice path to the semifinals in front of them. Still challenges, but they could see themselves there. As it turned out, though, they took second in the group. They play Argentina, and they remain stranded on that plateau, sort of among the second-tier teams. What do you make of Mexico?
Well, Mexico since you brought up the history, has also a real historical hurdle to overcome, which is that they have always been a regionally dominant team for decades, but never seen as a globally dominant team, never getting past the round of 16 except within their own country when they played it in 70 and 86. And I think that's a mental hurdle in some regards for them. This was an incredibly talented team, but the players that were the most talented in terms of the world stage were three very young strikers, Vela, Dos Santos, and Chicharito. And if they're going to be around in 4 years, and in 4 years, this team, if they get sort of their head on straight, as Rafa Marquez, their probably soon to be retiring captain center fullback, often says, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with, I think, finally, in Brazil in 4 years. But it's just the minute you saw this has happened time and time again. Something happens that doesn't go in their favor, and they start to lose composure on the big stage. And it was mentioned by some of the players, former players that I spoke to regarding my documentary, that they do play too much sometimes with their heart and not enough with their feet. And that gets them into trouble. And it was as soon as the Tevez goal went in, offside or not, their heads started going down. And the fact that it was controversial and they saw the actual, you know, bad call on the big screen, to me, the game was over at that point. It was very unlikely that they were going to have the composure and to come back. And now that the United States is, you know, challenging them for regional dominance, there's a belief that this is going to help them, that they don't have to just be that big fish in the small pond, because the United States is obviously shooting for higher things than just CONCACAF, and they don't want to fall behind.
So it's a very good point that the two regional powers now can push themselves. Now that the USA is established on the same plateau as Mexico, on the same plane, I think it's clear that the two could push themselves in that rivalry to the higher plane. And, of course, only time will tell.
Right. The challenge for Mexico is, can they continue to reinvent themselves to develop a youth system on par with Europe, to continue to mine their own domestic young players versus bringing in foreign players, which causes a lot of fractions within the Mexican fans as well as the players. For example, it's same as the EPL, the Mexican League, which is a well-funded league, the best paying league in the Western Hemisphere. For a while, there was only one or two Mexican-born strikers in the entire league. All the strikers were coming in from Argentina, Brazil. So, you know, that was like, well, where are our native-born strikers? For the United States, there's a sense, both in Mexico and within the United States, that they are just beginning to scratch the surface of their talent and their organization, and that they are, there's, the sky is the limit for the United States if they get, you know, if they keep building and slow incremental moves, keep developing the MLS, keep working on these new player academies that are based on the German style, which seems to be doing really well, as the Germans have pretty much every major youth championship right now, and obviously on the field in this World Cup, amazing young players. And that's what I sort of mean by the title of my film, you know, because the gringos are now at the gate. They're actually ready to be better than Mexico, and that is the biggest fear of Mexican soccer fans and the Mexican soccer federation in general. They could not handle the fact that the U.S. would become a regular quarterfinalist before Mexico becomes a regular quarterfinalist or a regular semifinalist, or God forbid, the U.S. would win a World Cup before Mexico. You know, but there's really few people that can't imagine the U.S. doing it if they keep getting better every 4 years as they have. Whereas Mexico, like you said, they're sort of stuck in this historical rut. You know, can they break out?
You are definitely also a person who's qualified to look at Mexico in terms of the broader social and political context of that country right now. And we spoke to a number of people at the beginning stage of the World Cup that a successful run for Mexico for El Tri in the 2010 World Cup would have provided a lot more than just solace, but for a country that has some severe social and political crises. It's rather clear, though, that that has not been the case, that this team did not provide that. So in that sense, the joy that people were looking for as an alleviation, as a relief, as a release, too, from a tough political context has not been provided.
Yeah. In terms of, like, the actual result, the advantage for Mexico was that they got beat by Argentina. And within the larger sort of football reality of Mexico, is there's no shame losing to Brazil or Argentina. They consider them sort of, those two teams, the, you know, archetype of important soccer teams and soccer cultures. So, but let's flip the situation. If it had been Mexico losing to Ghana, there would have been heads would have rolled. You know, they would have thought that is like a major loss of face for the entire program.
Right, and as much as USA had its extremely dramatic victory over Algeria, its extremely dramatic comeback against Slovenia, and a tie against, of course, one of the traditional footballing giants in England, Mexico did have that great moment where they basically slayed France.
Oh, yeah. But then again, I think the true soccer purists know that this was a year that people could beat France. I'll say one thing about the Mexican fans. They are very, very knowledgeable. I mean, I know them as having studied them now for 2 years. And, for example, like when they beat the United States in the Gold Cup at the last summer, they were very excited. We finally beat the United States 5-0. It was a huge game. I know that was their C team. So they kind of know, oh, it wasn't really the big U.S. squad. You know, they aren't so out of touch with what really is going on that they would become at least the people that I've spoken to. My co-director Roberto Donati is Mexican, was saying, you know, yeah, we beat France, but, you know, this was definitely a year we could beat France. It's not like we beat Germany. It's not like we beat, you know, Brazil.
Well, Pablo, we'll be talking to you again tomorrow here on the People's Game. And as always, thanks for your reflections on the 2010 tournament.
Well, thank you very much, Alan.
This is the People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Fatima Marquez. She was born and raised in Lisbon, Portugal. She is a resident of Southern California, and she is the proprietor of Nata's Pastry in Sherman Oaks, which are authentic Portuguese pastries available here in Southern California. Welcome to the show, Fatima.
Hi, how are you?
Well, you are a fan of the Portuguese national team. They made it to the semis last World Cup. They've had a great decade and a half as a national football side, incredible footballing tradition in Portugal. What do you make of this year's team?
Oh, my God, I am so excited. I think they're looking good. You know, I always feel that they could always be better. Starting off, they start off slow, but I think they're doing pretty good, so I have confidence.
Cristiano Ronaldo obviously is the superstar of superstars when it comes to this team and one of the biggest stars in the world in football. How do you think he's doing in the tournament so far?
Everyone talks that he, you know, he hasn't scored that much goals, this and that. I can see that, but I think he's, you know, it's not just about, it's about being a team player, and I think he's shown that he's helped his team, of course, and just to have him on the field, you know, he's just like a great big plus. So I think he's going to, tomorrow, I think he's probably going to show what he can do as far as scoring, hopefully.
Well, tomorrow the opponent is Spain, and we'll touch on that in a moment. But first, what happens to Portugal when the national team plays in the World Cup? How much excitement? Does everything stop?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I haven't lived in Portugal for a while now, but I am sure that if you don't show up to work and that sort of thing, it's not a big deal. Because soccer is huge at home. I was brought up there, of course, Lisbon, and I remember since I was a kid. I mean, it was Sunday church, and then we go and see soccer. It's just a traditional thing, something that you do since you are a kid, you know. And so it's a big thing. It's a big thing, yeah, bigger than anything.
Obviously, there are certain teams in certain countries in the world when they play, there's greater significance. Spain are the defending European champions, having finally won a major tournament in 2008. They are one of the tournament favorites. Portugal is considered one of the top sides in the world. They square off tomorrow in the World Cup second round match. What does that mean to Portugal, and what does it mean to you?
Oh, you know, Spain, we are right next door to each other. It's a love-hate relationship type of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to see Portugal show what they can do. And, of course, yeah, the Spanish are very good players, and the style of playing is fairly similar. But, yeah, it's nerve-wracking. I can't just wait to see it. We're preparing for a big party here, and we can't wait to see the game.
And so you'll be watching the game with a group of Portuguese fans,
yeah,
in Southern California?
Yes, yes.
So you're very excited for tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait. I wake up every morning. I've seen all the games.
Fatima Marquez, thank you so much for joining us here on the People's Game. And do you want to tell the folks out there just a little bit about Nata's Pastries?
Oh, sure. Nata's Pastries is LA's Portuguese bakery cafe. We are the only Portuguese bakery cafe restaurant in LA. It's awesome. We serve traditional dishes and regional sweets from Portugal. So come by.
Thank you so much for joining us on the People's Game.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Mr. Jose Perez. He is a Southern California resident who was born in Paraguay, and he is a partisan of the Paraguayan national football team that plays Japan tomorrow early in the morning, Los Angeles time, for a spot in the World Cup quarterfinals. Welcome to the show, Mr. Perez.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
What do you make of the team's chances against Japan tomorrow?
Well, they have great players. Japan has great players, but, you know, we're going with our A team. I think we're going to, pretty sure we are.
Paraguay is a very solid side, and certainly their best-known player internationally has been Roque Santa Cruz, but it seems that they have talented players and a very solid cohesion across the entire team. Is that your sense?
Yes, it is. I mean, we have a few players that are, all the players that are playing that are the premier lineup, so pretty that.
What will it mean to the people of Paraguay if the team makes it to the quarterfinals of the World Cup?
You know, everybody's really excited. Everybody has their flag up, and, you know, it would be a wonderful. Everybody would just cheer on the streets.
And are you going to be watching the game tomorrow in Southern California with a group of other Paraguayans and fans of Paraguay?
No, but a friend's house in Tila's by. So we're all getting together. I mean, there's only 400 Paraguayans in Southern California, in Los Angeles area. So, you know, there's not a lot of us, so we're all getting together and watching the game.
So Paraguay is a relatively small country, but soccer is by far the most popular sport there?
Yes, by far. I mean, whenever Paraguay plays, in my country, it's like holiday. Everybody stays home and watches the game. You know, it's like religion over there.
And is this one of the best teams that Paraguay has ever had?
I don't know about that, but, you know, they're a solid team. I'm pretty happy about the players. I mean, we had great teams over the past. I think we have a good team now, and we're hoping.
Mr. Jose Perez from Paraguay, I want to wish you the best of luck against Japan tomorrow, and may the 400 Paraguayans in Los Angeles have a happy day tomorrow.
All right. Thank you, sir.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and we are joined by David Winner. He is the author of a book that Fernando introduced to me and instantly became one of my all-time favorite books about soccer, Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. And I really don't think I can convey how exceptional a work this is. It is so illuminating, not only about Dutch soccer in its development and the development of total football in the 1970s in Holland, but also just about Dutch society. It's an elliptical work. It even declares that its chapters aren't in order. It's highly impressionistic. And in being that way, it is so insightful about Dutch soccer, about soccer theory and practice in general. It's a fantastic work, and we're very honored to have David Winner on the show with us today. So welcome to The People's Game, David.
Bless you. Keep going. You know, I don't want to butt in.
Well, let me just say, okay, I'll take one little quote here from The Guardian. Wry, obsessional, digressive, deep. This is football as art, metaphor, cultural signifier. So let's get into it then, because one of the things, and I suppose a striking thing about the book, is let's all think right now about the Netherlands and about Holland and what we know about it and what we think we know about it. Well, first of all, Dutch football, they're one of the great world footballing countries and national sides, but they were lousy in the 50s and 60s. So it all came together in the 70s. So what can you tell us first about Dutch football in the 50s and 60s and before that?
Deeply amateurish, backwater, of no international interest to anybody at all, barely of interest to the Dutch themselves. Not a minority sport, though it had been until fairly late. Then in the 50s, what the crucial thing that happens is that amateurism, it makes a little bit of space for professionalism. At one point, there's a player called Arbe Lentstra, who's probably the best before Cruyff. He gets into trouble for being, you know, interested in money. And then there's another one, Fars Vilkas, who's the boyhood hero of Cruyff. He has to go off and play in Italy. But professionalism comes, I think it's 54, And then after that, there's a development. And then it's still a bit of a backwater, though remember also clubs such as Bayern Munich, you know, Germany goes professional around about that time. And these superpower leagues that we now think of, they come to professionalism very late, much later than the Italians and Spanish, you know, decades after the British, after the English. And that's a big change. And then at Ajax, which is the main Amsterdam club, it ends up as the only Amsterdam club, in the early 60s, round about exactly the same time that the sort of hippie, what becomes the hippie movement, Amsterdam Magic Center, it becomes later. It starts off as a kind of a youth revolt. It becomes the Provo, sort of hippie, proto-hippie movement. Just as that's kicking off in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam becomes one of the centers of the sort of counterculture 60s phenomenon. Exactly the same moment, two guys come together at Ajax in what is already a club full of very technical, rather quiet, but rather technical, skillful, craft-filled players who've in a club which has got a tradition of attacking football, even from the amateur football days of the sort of First World War and just after that era and through the interwar period. Johan Cruyff, this 17-year-old genius player, you know, comparable really only with Pelé and Maradona as the world's historic, you know, great player. And the coach, Rinus Michels, who had been a sort of ebullient, garrulous, sort of jolly centre-forward just after the war for Ajax. He comes and he's transformed and becomes this very ambitious, very Holland's first really sort of self-taught, super clever, very ambitious, disciplined coach. And between them, they become this sort of joint catalyst for an absolute revolution. I can't think of any equivalent any place in soccer ever, where you go from being really a backwater and of no interest to anybody to being the most radical, the most interesting, the most stylish, skillful, innovative in world football in the space of sort of 6-7 years. And by the early 70s, Ajax are European champions. They've developed a new form of the game called, which the journalists call total football, which has two main tactical elements. It's like switching positions and rotating and being very free about playing creatively and pressing. It's now sort of these elements are sort of standard now, but it's an absolute sensation. So you press and play a very high offside line and then just spend the whole game just pouring forward and attacking, dominating, overwhelming opponents. You see it now, direct continuation, speeded up, of course, because the athletic abilities are much greater now, so it all has to be done much more quickly. But at Barcelona, that's basically what they were doing, and you see Barcelona, and it takes your breath away sometimes. And that's the same kind of effect when it was invented. It was even more extraordinary. And that's basically what happened.
So Holland, also in the 1950s and 1960s, was a very conservative country. There was a social transformation around the Western world with the 1960s, early 1970s. In many respects, that took place in just a parallel way with soccer, and both of them stuck in Holland. Since that time, Holland, and particularly Amsterdam, has been thought of as one of the libertine capitals of the world, and Dutch football has remained exceptional. And, you know, there certainly are other national sides that sort of blip up with these golden generations. Hungary, of course, comes to mind from the 1950s, and then they sort of fade down and become second-rate football teams, national teams. That didn't happen with Holland. So what were the institutions in soccer that have maintained this in Holland? And then to go along with that, how significant is football in contemporary Dutch culture, you know, since the 1970s?
The short answer to the second part of that is very, and it gets bigger all the time. There was an idea lurking behind the question, which I would challenge slightly, because you know, everything is fluid, everything is changing. We're talking about the 70s, that sort of 40, the late 60s, you know, 40, 45 years ago. The soccer of that time was a product of that moment, culturally, historically, developmentally. It's, you know, Holland is not quite the same Holland as it was, and you can see a reflection of that in the football mm-hmm. that they're playing at the moment in the World Cup, which is not, you know, the free-flowing, adorable, romantic, slightly fragile, but, you know, very inspiring, beautiful stuff that I fell in love with, but which seemingly did not end up with them winning the World Cup. They're the biggest soccer country that's not won the, you know, it's only one of the great soccer powers that's not won the World Cup. You know, now you talked about it, it's a sort of libertine culture, and it was associated with a sort of very free-floating, leftist, liberal kind of politics that came to dominate anyway, and it sort of broke through in the 60s. Now that's rather changed. In the recent Dutch election a couple of weeks ago, there's a huge breakthrough for Geert Wilders' party, which is, you know, there's other stuff going on in it as well, but it's somewhat racist, and you know, a heavy proportion of Dutch voters voted for that. It increased its seats from, I forget the numbers, it's something like 9 to 25, something like that, mm-hmm. in the Dutch parliament. So, and at the same time, and the parallels are never exact, and they, you know, you can easily overstate them and look silly. But it's strange that Bertrand Marwijk's team is currently playing, you know, the exact opposite of total football. It's very strange. I'm having conversations all the time, and I'm puzzled, and I don't know how I feel about it. But to see Holland playing, you know, like a sort of German team of the sort of 80s and 90s. Or not quite in the style, but you know, defending like a classic Italian idea of how you win World Cups. You know, they're doing the minimum to get past opponents. They're revealing their skills very little. They're doing the kind of Italian thing of minimal effort, just do what it takes to get through and then wait for the next one. And the next game is Brazil, and Brazil look a much more complete and much more attractive team. And that's more or less the first time. Previously, when Holland and Brazil have met, Holland have actually been the more skillful team and the more expressive team. And it's a very odd moment. So, you know, all these things are fluid.
The institutional structure to keep Dutch football, because, I mean, it is conspicuous.
Yeah, it got very big. It got very popular. Mm-hmm. Partly it's a kind of social, cultural thing that swept certainly the whole of Western Europe, all of Europe. And increasingly the rest of the world in the pop, that as other forms of, you know, just entertainment, but storytelling, you might say, mm-hmm. You know, film looks to a large degree predictable, and television we've got a bit bored with, and religion and old kind of political identities have faded a bit. So sports generally and soccer most of all kind of fills the vacuum, and the institutions were partly the professional clubs and the Dutch Football Association. But in Holland, it's a very clubby sort of culture, and huge numbers, I mean, vast numbers of people in Holland play soccer with their local club or with a club that they're a member of. And it's a game that people play at least as much as watch. And Frank Beckenbauer, the story goes that he flew over the Netherlands once and looked down and saw that there were huge numbers of soccer pitches, and he said, "Oh, that's why this little country is so good." Because it's a bit like New Zealand. I don't know if New Zealand play rugby to a phenomenal level, because they all do it. The Welsh used to be like that as well. But that's basically it. It's a major sort of plank of identity and national identity as well. I think, you know, every 2 years, with occasional accidents where they don't qualify, there's this sort of giant oranging of the country. The national identity is now very, very closely tied up with football. It's something they're deeply proud of, and it's a vibrant football culture.
Speaking with David Winter, he is the author of the book Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. You know, it's a very conspicuous achievement, though, for the national soccer side, because everybody expects them to be, for instance, one of the, top-ranked group. They get the top ranking for the group going into the World Cup, and there are eight teams that get that. And of those eight teams in this year's World Cup, Holland is more than three times smaller than the next smallest country that, again, would expect it to be there, which is Argentina. So it's a great achievement for a country of that size. Let's look a little bit at this year's team because, you know, they're very efficient. I would argue that they're still sort of, at least, if they're not playing total football in a creative manner, all the players out on the field certainly, you know, they do have the capacity to shift positions and that. I agree it's not a particularly magical side. And, you know, as they head into Brazil, the only reason I would really give them a chance is simply because of how spectacular Ian Robin has been over the past 4 months.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So
Alien Robin, they were calling him on Dutch, on Italian telly.
Why is that?
Well, just like he's a creature from outer space.
He has the most peculiar way of moving around when he doesn't have the ball and when he scores goals of sort
of. He looks like an old man with severe arthritis.
Right. Well, you know. Yeah, very pink.
If he's going to run for a bus, you know, you think he'd fall over or you'd go and have to pick him up or something. And then the ball comes towards him and he's transformed into Usain Bolt with, you know, the most delicate touch.
Well,
it's amazing.
But
he's thrilling. And he also, there's something that moved me very much today. The cameras, traditionally the Dutch, you know, when the national anthem comes at the beginning of the game, the Dutch, all the old sort of the 70s guys and the 80s guys especially, would just kind of look bored and stare into space and chew gum and kind of not be interested in any way. And Arjen Robben today was, his eyes were closed. He was singing the anthem. He very nearly didn't play in this World Cup. There's the last couple of minutes of a warm-up game where the Dutch looked spectacular. Just a week, you know, it was the day they flew down to South Africa, actually. They played in the afternoon, and then that evening they went to the airport. But in the last 5 minutes of the game, Arjen Robben, 6-1 up, he attempts a ridiculous showing off, little back heel, and injures himself. And the whole team was in tears. You know, the whole stadium was shocked. And it looked very much as if the best Dutch player in a long time, one of the absolute greats of world football at the moment, the season he had with Bayern Munich was unbelievable.
Right.
Looked like he'd crocked himself. looked like he just, and he stared into the abyss and thought, you know, I'm not going to make it. And then he worked with this fabulous therapist called Dick Van Toorn, who's kind of got him better, and he's now fit to face Brazil. So he's there, and he doesn't. One of the things that is distinguished or marked in a mark of Kane way, the Dutch teams of the past, they've first of all not taken their own sort of brilliance seriously, and then they've undermined it by, you know, not taking opponents seriously, you know, talking about anything but football, being very unprofessional very often. And here at last you've got a fabulous talented player completely devoted to his craft and to the honor really of playing in a World Cup. It's very moving to see him.
So what do you make of the team then? They were able in their last warm-up to play a very free-flowing, beautiful form of Dutch total football, yet they've gotten into the tournament and they've sort of played more conservatively.
They come into this tournament with a completely different frame of mind to almost all their previous ones. They've come to win, and oddly they've never actually done that before, even in 74, which was the best team. They had a kind of funny mixture of certainty that they were the best, which they were, and insecurity about, well, you know, we're just a little country and we've never been in a World Cup before. That was their first major World Cup. They played in the 30s, but in the modern era, this was the first time. And they somehow, there was a combination of sort of superiority-inferiority complex, which I think accounts for some of the disasters that they would bring on themselves. This time is different to all the other times because they've come to win. And they say, you know, they've looked at all their failures. There's a chapter in the book actually called Death Wish about the extraordinary ways in which the Dutch have managed to find ways to defeat themselves most of the time. And they would nearly always go into tournaments with the best collection of players, or at least the equal best. I mean, in 1990, for example, they had a phenomenal collection of players. Mm-hmm. There was Schüller, Rijkaard, Van Basten, Koeman, Wouters. Even the defense was good, which it isn't always. And they went home without winning a single game. They couldn't even beat Egypt because they were arguing amongst themselves. They didn't want the coach they had. They wanted Cruyff. They wanted more money. No, it wasn't more money actually that time. It was status. It was the team divided into sort of three cliques. Players weren't talking to each other. It was just a disaster. It was like the French this time. Not quite as bad, but they didn't go on strike. But it was just horrible. And that was a team that should have walked the World Cup. And they were much better than on paper, and as they were on other occasions. They were much better than everybody else. 94 in the States, they didn't bring Ruud Gullit, because Ruud Gullit walked out in the last, sort of few days before the plane left. Over tactics or status or money. Nobody, he never really explained it. Ruud Gullit, he wasn't quite at his peak by then, but he was still a phenomenal player.
98 was an amazing team.
98, they were magnificent. Right. But here's the weird thing. They didn't think so. I did an interview with Dennis Bergkamp recently, and I asked him about, one of the most painful games that I can remember, the semi-final against Brazil in 98, where Holland were the dominant team and lost on penalties, and they should have had a penalty in the last minute when Pierre van Hooijdonk was pulled down, and instead the referee yellow-carded him, thinking he dived, and he hadn't. He'd been pulled down, his cameras from behind the goal showed. And I asked him about that game. I said, why didn't you win that? And Bergkamp's answer was very interesting. He said, well, we never really expected to be at that level. We thought we were going to lose to Argentina in the quarterfinal, and then we suddenly found ourselves in the semi. And we didn't really expect to be there. And you think that's just mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that was an astonishing talented group. So they went in with a kind of losing mentality. They almost always went in with a losing mentality. And this time, they've studied the problem. Bertrand Marwijk has a different, he's not an old Ajax coach. He's not quite so associated. He was a Feyenoord man. He's not associated in the same way with this Dutch tradition, with Cruyff, with this thing of which is very much an Amsterdam thing. You bluff, you look good, you kind of, it's like a capital city pretty much anywhere. Or the big city thing, you kind of look good, and that's being stylish is important. He's not that interested in that. I mean, he's part of the Dutch tradition, but his main thing is like, we come, we win. That's all. And he studied it. He's decided that the most important thing is to play. You don't exhaust yourself by looking good in the early rounds in matches which don't ultimately count, as happened at the last Euros when they beat Italy and France, bumped them. Disposed of Romania very easily, and then crashed out in the most feeble manner in the quarterfinal game against Russia. He says, we're not doing that this time. We'll be boring if necessary. We'll just get the points. We'll come through the early rounds, and then we'll play, whatever it takes to get through. It's completely new for the Dutch.
Well,
I don't know how I feel about it. It would be quite miserable if they play like this in a sort of defensive way, counter attacking way, rather cagey fashion, and then go out to Brazil after, that would feel very sad. On the other hand, if they beat Brazil, and then I think they'd go on to the final, I wouldn't complain for a moment.
Right.
And there's this debate is happening in Holland right now. They're thinking, is this really what we want, to play like an old Germany team? Because the Germans this time are much more attractive than the Dutch. It changes. There's a big argument about that in Holland at the moment. As long as he keeps winning, it's not going to be a problem. But if they come home after a not good performance against Brazil, people will be quite unhappy.
That is only about the first third of the discussion we had with David Winter, author of Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Soccer. In the coming days, we'll be playing the rest of the interview here on The People's Game. I want to thank producer Fernando Romero, Pablo Morales, Jose Perez, and Fatima Marquez. I'm Alan Minsky. Tune in again tomorrow for The People's Game.
have unity under the sun. Everybody will sing and dance, and every nation will get that chance.